this point, we've had a look at all eight steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. Seeing the eight facets of the Dhamma jewel, if you will. Ways of working with and understanding the one reality in which we all abide. So those steps again are right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. But does the path end at collectedness of mind, at samadhi? Not really, huh? The Buddha said many times in the canon, he said, you'll know when you're done. You will know when you're done. You will say to yourself, I have set down the burden. There is no more to be done in this life. And many of the folks who talk about their awakening or whose awakening is described in the canon said those words, that they had set down the burden. So if you haven't arrived at that point, and I don't say that sarcastically because I do really believe that it's possible, as Ayananda Bodhi mentioned this morning, then there's still a journey for you, a journey of practice. And I would propose that we can't really know where we are in that journey, because its unfolding is something that's new. That's what we mean by realization. We mean an absolutely life-changing experience of reality in a way that we've never experienced before. The Buddha himself said that practice of awakening is gradual. In the Kudaka, which is one of the, thought to be one of the earliest texts, he says, the path is like the ocean. It gradually slopes to the depths. And perhaps riffing on that, Dhamma teacher Tina Rasmussen, in a book that she wrote with Stephen Schneider on the jhanas, gives this lovely simile about scuba divers. And she says, when you're deep sea diving and you're entering from the shore, not from a boat, not dropping in from a boat, but actually entering the ocean from the shoreline, then what you do is you strap on all of your gear, right? You put on a mask and a tank and fins and maybe a weight belt and maybe a flashlight and various other pieces of equipment. And then you walk into the ocean backward. Step by step, you walk into the ocean backward. And while you're doing that, the waves are coming, the waves are approaching the shore. And you can't necessarily see them or hear them coming because you're walking backward. Right? So you might get pushed and pulled a bit by the waves, or you might actually get fully knocked down by the waves. Or your mask might come off and then you have to stop and clean it off and put it back on. But eventually, after some period of walking backward, then you get to the deeper part of the ocean. And when you get there, then you realize what all that equipment is good for. All that equipment suddenly becomes a lot more useful and not such a hassle. And you can explore places that you never even imagined, creatures that you've never seen before, that have always been there, that were already there, but are new to your experience. And it's a beautiful simile because the forms of practice are like this equipment. Like your tank of air and your fins and your mask and your flashlight. These are what the forms of practice do for us. They are supports. They are supports, instruments for our own entering of the depths. And then, at various points in our journey, we begin to use them or experience them differently. Some become more useful, some become less useful. To extend the metaphor just a little bit, some folks, after learning how to deep sea dive, become free divers and toss off most of their equipment and use just a rope and their breath to explore the depths. And to continue extending the simile a little bit further, perhaps you might realize that from the moment you stepped into the water, you have been in the ocean. Whether you were in the shallows or in the depths. And you might go further and even realize that you yourself are also made of salt water. The wisdom of the ocean is already fully imbued in this body. That's what the Buddha taught, right here in this body and mind, is the full capacity for awakening. So we can't really know where we are in the process, I would propose. But there is a process, and we have plenty of tools, plenty of frameworks, plenty of descriptions of the ocean. But as we say in the later Buddhist traditions, just saying that is like a painted rice cake. It doesn't actually nourish you. It doesn't actually resolve your hunger for awakening. Because this is the path to the end of suffering. This is the path to liberation. So there is a moment of realization. Continuing on, the Buddha said, just as the ocean has the one taste of salt, the Dhamma has the one taste of release. It unfolds naturally in that direction. To that final moment of relinquishing all greed, hatred, and delusion of self. So you may or may not be practicing with that idea in mind, with that goal in mind, but nonetheless, practice is transformational in many ways. So in keeping with the theme of the poems of the Terrys, I brought a poem today from Citta. Citta, a word that means heart or mind. This is her poem. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak. Old, too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath, and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. Beautiful, right? That moment. So both things are true. The millennia-old debate about whether enlightenment is gradual or sudden. Both and, right? There is a moment of realization, and yet no moment arises without innumerable causes and conditions which make it possible. That's the gradual part. That's our work to be done. And Citta, we like to focus on the end part about where it slipped off her shoulders, but she mentions the beginning part too, right? She mentions how she was tired and hungry and old, that somehow she kept climbing. The backstory to this poem is Citta, we don't know much about her biography per se. We know that she was ordained as an adult woman, a mature woman. She practiced for some period of time. And after a period of time of practicing together, she felt that she needed some time of seclusion, some time to practice on her own. And this is the result. She went off, she climbed up the mountain to practice on her own. And in the poem, she says a few things that give us some hints. So she was tired, she was had been practicing hard. She felt weak, she didn't feel particularly strong at that moment in time. She set down her staff and bowl and took a deep breath. Oh. And then she says, she adds this one line that I find very interesting. She says, it was windy up there. So wind, or air element, in the old Indian tradition is associated with movement. Like there's a shift happening. And she leans back against the rock. For that moment, she set down her striving and leans back against the rock, held by the earth. Does that sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Buddha touching the earth? So both things are true. And we walk this journey ourselves. No one can do it for us. Even the Buddha himself could not do it for you if he were alive today. And one reason for that is because each one of us is a completely unique set of khandhas. We are a completely unique set of body and mind, with all of our complexities and our tendencies and our faults and our goodness and our history, our hopes. It's said that there are as many teachings as there are minds. This is not mind as a totality, but mind as our experience, our human experience. So there's a koan that I want to bring forth at this moment that addresses this way of understanding the personal nature of the journey. So, and in this particular koan, I don't think that we have the names of the student and the teacher who were involved. But as I said yesterday, a koan is a story that is an old precedent. It's a teaching moment that is a pointer at how we might work with our own practice. And all koans, I would propose, aim at showing us, demonstrating for us, how the mundane, subjective world is fully an expression of the absolute principles of all of reality, that those two things are inseparable. So in this koan, it's a very brief one, in this koan, the student comes to the teacher and asks a question, as they often start that way, the koans. The student says, what is the teaching of a lifetime? What is the teaching of a lifetime? And the teacher replies, an appropriate response. An appropriate response. I really enjoy this koan because for me it has so many levels of meaning, so many different layers of meaning. At least two or three that I would bring forth today. One way of understanding this dialogue is to say, the student is asking, what's the highest teaching? What is the teaching of a lifetime? What's the highest teaching? Just give me the main one, okay? Don't bother me with all the little ones. Just give me the really important one. And the teacher says, an appropriate response. That is, that the highest teaching is the teaching that responds and meets you where you are right now in this moment. There isn't one highest teaching other than the one that meets you right now where you are at this moment. That's one way to understand the dialogue. Another way to understand the dialogue is, what is the teaching of a lifetime? What's a teaching? What is a way for me to practice for the rest of my lifetime? How can I really apply myself to this path? What is the teaching of an entire lifetime? An appropriate response. The practice of an entire lifetime is for us to meet our lives, to discern an appropriate response, to be able to be present with what is in a way that is absolutely harmonious, skillful, wise. That is the practice of a lifetime. It's a high bar. But arguably, one that's worth our time, one that's worth our effort. And finally, a third way of understanding this dialogue, which is probably not the way that it was intended, would be to see it in the context of the earlier Buddhist teachings. So the teaching of a lifetime, what does this lifetime mean? What is the teaching of this lifetime? And this teaching of this lifetime is an appropriate response, meaning it is the response to your karma. It is the vipaka, it is the consequence of the karma that has been produced in this particular karmic stream, this life that you're living. So don't forget that. Don't forget cause and effect. Cause and effect is integral to our lives, and we ignore it at our peril. So as you can see, it's a very personal journey. It's a very intimate journey, this one. I think that's also part of why we emphasize the need to be kind. To be really kind with ourselves and with others when we're walking this path. Because when you walk this path, you will see, inevitably, if you're looking, you will see the ways in which you're creating suffering, you're creating harm, you're creating confusion, you're creating anger. You will see those things. And if you're not kind to yourself when you see those things, then you will just stop looking. Then you'll just go back to sleep. So kindness is really an important part of the journey for all of us. And perhaps different parts of the path come forth at different points for us. So maybe if you're confused about why you're practicing, then you go back to right view or right intention, and really try to dig in there. Or maybe if you're finding a lack of joy in your path or a lack of ease in your path, then you look to the ethical practices. Because as I said a few days ago, the Buddha said that the purpose of leading an ethical life is to drop remorse and eventually arrive at joy. So you go with right speech, or you dig into right action, or you look at your livelihood. or if you feel stuck in your meditation, or you feel like you're not able to make progress, or you feel that you haven't quite reached the depths, then you could look at the samadhi aspect, or the sati, or the right effort, balanced, continuous, sustainable effort. Ajahn Chah has something to say about that. He says in a book called Still Forest Pool, an old text gathering together Ajahn Chah's teachings. He is one of the revered teachers in the Thai forest tradition, teacher to many of the more well-known Western monastics. He said this, "Proper effort is not the effort to make something particular happen. It is the effort to be aware and awake in each moment, the effort to overcome laziness and defilement, the effort to make each activity of our day meditation." Not the effort to force something particular to happen. Right? Going back to this part about how we can't see clearly the unfolding of the path, to have some humility about not knowing, and an openness, a curiosity about our practice. What is it? Because it's not going to be the kind of thing that you can just analyze, that you can just tick off the lists. The lists are helpful, the lists are pointers. But we have to actually go to the mystery. Give ourselves over to that mystery. And our lives are very mysterious in some ways. Very mysterious. So I'll close with a little bit of an example of that, a story about a time when I was in Japan. So I was a recently ordained nun in the Soto Zen tradition, and I was practicing at a temple called Hoshinji. It means something like beginner's mind temple in Japan, in a little fishing village on what they call the backside of the main island. And the primary translator, so it's a relatively small monastery, bigger than Alokavihara, but relatively small, maybe about 22 people at the time that I arrived, monks and nuns, Westerners and Asian folks, and all kinds of folks mixed together. And the teacher is Seke Harada Roshi. He's still alive, he's there, he's retired now due to illness. But I was recently arrived, and as distinct from the Theravada tradition, Zen monks and Chan monks garden. They do a lot of grow a lot of their own food. So I was in the garden, and we all were, because it's mostly communal work. Everybody doing the same work together, except maybe one person cooking and one person trying to answer the phones. And I had been given the task of picking some chamomile flowers for tea. So we had this German chamomile bush, and I don't know if you've ever seen one, but it kind of grows in this round shape, and it's tiny, tiny little twigs, little branches, like the size of a thread, literally the size of a thread, these little branches. And they grow in all different directions. And then all around the outside are these tiny, beautiful, delicate little white flowers with little yellow centers. And the flower is the part that you pick for the tea, as distinct from like green tea where you pick the leaves. So there I was, and Shodo, this German monk who was the primary translator there, Shodo is an incredibly vigorous human being. He was quite the character. And I have many stories of good practice times with Shodo, who's now gone back to Berlin and is raising a family, actually. But at the time, Shodo had asked me to pick the chamomile. So I sat down on this little wooden bench thing to start picking, because you need maybe thousands of flowers in order to have a, you know, even a bag full of chamomile tea. And I immediately noticed like these flowers in all different states of being. Like there were little buds, they weren't open yet, and there were flowers that had only just started to break open, and there were ones with all their petals, ones with just a couple of petals left. There were ones where all the petals had fallen off and it was just the head, the center part of the flower. And this Japanese Zen practice is very precise, very precise. Usually the instructions you're given are extremely detailed. Not to get off on a tangent, but as an example, when the senior nun asked me to chop carrots for the soup, she said, cut them in a matchstick shape, and she handed me a matchstick. They need to look like this. So when I noticed that about the flowers, I thought, well, I better check in and see, like, you know, what's requested here, what am I supposed to be doing? So I called over to Shodo, who was just a few feet away from me, and I said, Shodo, you know, these flowers, they're like in all different states of opening, and I'm not really sure which ones I'm supposed to be picking, or like what's the proper thing for the tea. And Shodo stopped and he looked at me and he said, I can't do the German accent, but he said, are you asking me when a flower becomes a flower? Yes? Yes, I said. And Shodo just looked at me for a second and shook his head and went back to gardening. Went back to his task. Just refused to answer the question. Right? Beautiful teaching, right? You don't need a diagram. You don't need to count petals. Don't worry. When the flower blooms, you'll know. When the flower blooms, you'll know.